I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, It's Not Your Imagination, America is more polarized than it's ever been in our lifetimes, and we shouldn't hold our breath waiting for politicians to come up with solutions. We'll spend this hour with writer Michael Tomasky, who will explain how the surge of national unity brought on by the Great Depression and World War II was dismantled starting in the 1970s, when many Americans struggling to survive out-of-control inflation rates took on a look-out-for-number-one mentality. We'll talk about Tomasky's recommendations for rebuilding a sense that we're all in this together, from adding congressional seats and creating some at-large districts to trimming bachelor's degree programs to 3 years and encouraging young adults to do a year of service in an unfamiliar part of the country. Our conversation starts after a short break. When a conversation turns to how divided America feels right now, somebody will inevitably bring up the fact that it was way worse during the Civil War. That's true, of course, but the literal dissolution of the Republic is lower than most of us want to set the bar, especially when we think about how unified we have been in times as challenging as the Great Depression or the Second World War. How have we let so much political division creep back into the culture? And what can we do about it if our political leaders insist on adding fuel to the partisan fire? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Michael Tomasky is a columnist for The Daily Beast and contributing opinion writer for The New York Times. His new book is called If We Can Keep It, How the Republic Collapsed and How It Might Be Saved. He joins us from NPR in Washington to talk about it. Michael, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
First off, we should acknowledge that your assessment that we've always been pretty deeply divided in this country is a thing. What did Federalists and Democratic Republicans fight about in the 18th and early 19th centuries?
Pretty much, pretty much the same thing that we're fighting about today, that Democrats and Republicans are fighting about today, the size and scope and power of the federal government. The Federalists were for a large central government. Alexander Hamilton was their leader, sort of, and Thomas Jefferson led the Democratic Republicans. The Federalists were the big city people, the swells, the coastal elites, just like today. And the Jeffersonians were the backwoods folks, the yeoman farmers, as they said. And they distrusted a large central government. The Hamiltonians wanted a national bank. They won the first couple fights, but then by 1815, the Federalists were gone.
So the divisions we've had in this country have not always split cleanly along party lines. Were those intra-party quarrels, once we had Republicans and Democrats, were they less visible to average citizens in the past than they are to us today?
Well, probably so, because there just was no omnipresent media in those days. You know, we're going back to the early 19th century and talking about these things. But this is... this is one of the important points of the book. Because of some factors that were unique to America, unique to the United States, our parties grew in a strange way. If you look at how the parties took shape in Europe, how political parties grew in Europe after the countries of Europe tossed off monarchies and became democratic republics, in most or all, really, of the major constitutional democracies of Europe, there was a party of the left and a party of the right. You know, for example, in England, the liberals and the conservatives, or the Tories. Labor came later in the 20th century. In Germany, the Christian Democrats and the Social Democrats. A party of the left and a party of the right. Now, here in the United States, we didn't have that. This is partly because of slavery and the way they chose to handle the slavery issue in the early days of the Republic. It was partly because the country was growing and adding states. And so the parties were in this constant state of flux and adding coalition partners to these parties that already existed. So they were strange parties, and there was no ideological consistency in the parties. The Democratic Party of the late 19th century was a party of Southern segregationists and then a party of Northern machine politicians like Boss Tweed. Hmm. They didn't have much in common. They did have to nominate a president every 4 years, so they managed to do that. But our parties were very strange amalgams. That means, though, that there was a lot of overlap. So there was a lot of potential for compromise. And that lasted up until very recently in historical terms. And it was in the 1960s when the party started to split apart.
The great ideological sorting is what you call it.
Yes. Again, there's a great deal of overlap from the early 1800s up through the 1960s. And that's what made a lot of this compromise. Older listeners may remember a day when there was a lot of getting along in Congress, and there were a lot of bipartisan votes to pass things like civil rights and voting rights and Medicare in 1965. Those kinds of bipartisan votes don't happen today, and they don't happen because there's no more overlap. And the parties went off in two different directions. And yes, the Republicans have gone further from the center than the Democrats have, but both parties have gone away from the center, and that's why we have no compromise today.
Does the refinement of polling have anything to do with this? The idea that politicians feel as if they can drill down and know exactly what the exact number of people they need to be elected want from them and just serve that constituency.
Oh, absolutely. I would say the first thing that drove this division was the issues themselves, civil rights and race, feminism and gender politics and abortion, immigration politics, and then finally economic stagnation, which was also a very serious phenomenon of the 1970s. So it was issues more than anything else, but at the same time that those issues were driving the parties and people, okay, Chris, and us too, not just the parties. But at the same time, those issues were driving us apart. Certain practices came into being in politics that accentuated the divisions and that heightened them even further. And you point to one, the professionalization of political consulting and polling, which, as you say, made people realize, well, and I've talked to politicians about this, they'd say, I had polling that showed me I would lose 6 points if I cast that vote. And they cast the vote and lost 6 points. Hmm. It's that precise. It makes for a different kind of politics. It makes it harder, probably, to build coalitions. Also, of course, the dramatic rise of money in politics over the course of the 1970s and 80s, which was a huge factor. Also, the rise of a lot of these interest groups and rating groups, you know, that rate members of Congress's votes. So if you cast a wrong vote, quote-unquote ideologically wrong vote, you're going to lose donations or you're going to lose support. So a lot of factors like that have been very important as well.
If we are all so dissatisfied with polarization, Michael, why does it persist?
Because these are very powerful, historical and institutional factors that people can't just overcome. I mean, that's another main point of this book that I really want readers to take away. You hear a lot of people talk on cable TV and complain, why can't these people just get along like they used to? Well, no, it's not just a matter of will. Will is very overrated. And it's not because they're worse people or they're not as nice people. Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell are presiding over a lot of dysfunction in the United States Senate. 50 years ago, Mike Mansfield, who led the Democrats, and Everett Dirksen, who led the Republicans, presided over a fair amount of cooperation. But it wasn't because Mansfield and Dirksen were superior human beings. It was because social and historical forces were different. And I write at one point in the book, if you take Schumer and McConnell back to 1964, they would have presided over a fair amount of compromise and getting along. But if you move Mansfield and Dirksen up to today, they'd be presiding over exactly the same degree of dysfunction that Schumer and McConnell are presiding over.
So we can't recreate the conditions that allowed for some compromise in the middle part of the 20th century. But what made 1945 through 1980 an era of bipartisanship?
I think mainly the common experiences that people went through of the Depression and World War II. There was a lot of shared sacrifice in those two events, And these are big seismic events. These affected everybody. And we were a very different country in those days, too. the average household income in 1935 was $1,524. Now, you adjust that for inflation to today, and that's about $28,000. Well, the poverty level for a family of four today is about $25,000. Hmm. So in other words, the average family of 1935 was near poor by today's standards. It made for a whole different way of looking at the world when the hardship hit and 25% of people were unemployed and people really needed help from their neighbors to get by. It was a time of shared sacrifice and a sort of pulling together. We also weren't consumers yet then in the way we became beginning in the 1950s and then especially in the 1980s. So it was a time of common striving. And then the war, even more so, Chris, because of course that was a time for people to unite together to defeat fascism, to defeat Hitler and Japan, and people really did sacrifice. And the rationing, I have a section in the book that describes the rationing that people submitted to and agreed to in those days, which I don't think Americans of today would sit still for 5 minutes, even in the case of a world war. So we were just a different people. And finally, to conclude the point, when the men, and they were mostly men in those days, who had lived through those experiences, went to Washington, they had a certain perspective about them. You know, if you helped storm Utah Beach or liberate Buchenwald or fought in Okinawa, you don't look across the aisle in the House of Representatives and think of that person as an enemy.
Hmm. So this was also an era when Keynesian economic policies seemed like a fair prospect for the country. For folks without a background in economics, can you remind us of John Maynard Keynes's philosophies?
Sure. He's a British economist and, you know, put very simply, he advocated public investment, particularly during downturns when there wasn't as much money in the private economy to be invested. And he also said that, running deficits is fine for a while within a certain reasonable range. And so it was also demand side. It was called demand-side economics in that it was designed to create demand in the public for goods, which and he saw a robust role for the government to help do that, to help guide the economy and create that demand. It helped get the country and the developed world, actually, out of the Depression, although it really wasn't until World War II that we were fully out of the Depression. But Keynesian principles also governed how we financed the war when deficits were massive and taxes were really, really high. And Keynesian principles also governed how we ran the country from 1945 until the late 1970s. Lots of public investment, interstate highways most notably, but scientific research, all kinds of things, and very high tax rates. And higher government regulation than now, not as high ever as Europe, but higher than now. And everything was going great until the mid to late 1970s. So nobody ever questioned Keynesianism because we were a prosperous country and people could go down to the factory after high school and hold a job for the rest of their lives or most of their lives and they could raise their family on it and buy a house. Inflation was under control. The GDP was growing 4, 5, 6% a year. Everything was fine until it wasn't.
My guest is Daily Beast columnist Michael Tomasky. We're talking about his new book, If We Can Keep It, How the Republic Collapsed and How It Might Be Saved. You can join our conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can find us on Twitter at KERATHINK. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Michael Tomasky, who is a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times and columnist for the Daily Beast. His book is called If We Can Keep It, How the Republic Collapsed and How It Might Be Saved. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. So, Michael, Keynesian economics worked in the United States until it didn't, when inflation began to soar out of control starting in the 1970s. Did Keynesian economics cause the problems we had with inflation?
There's a big debate about that, sort of, but it was mostly like the Vietnam War, the costs of the Vietnam War, and Johnson's desire not to increase taxes. So that's a combination of things. Also, some things having to do with monetary policy that the Federal Reserve was following at the time. So no, not explicitly, but it was complicated.
But we have, at the same time, this gut punch of rising inflation, wage stagnation, deindustrialization, all those good factory jobs you mentioned were starting to dissolve. Suddenly putting away money for the future just in a savings account did not seem like enough. We had to invest our savings or risk seeing them worth less than the day we earned them. Talk about how that played into what we're talking about today.
Yeah, I like this part of the book, I must say, because it's not usually part of the story of polarization, at least in books by political writers. But I think it's really very, very important. People should remember or be reminded of what inflation was like in those days. I mean, today the target that the Federal Reserve sets for inflation is 2%. Over the course of the 1970s, year by year, inflation was 5%, 6%, 8%, sometimes 11%. It was really crazy and absolutely punishing. And as you said, people's savings accounts were losing money, and people were just falling behind in ways that Americans had never fallen behind. This came after the oil crisis of 1973, which was another big factor in there, along with deindustrialization, wage stagnation, all of these things hitting. It did two things. It opened the door for a different kind of economics. So out of mainly the University of Chicago and led by Milton Friedman, there was this other group of economists who were trying for years to argue against Keynesian principles, and they weren't getting much of an audience. But then suddenly in the mid-1970s, with all these problems, they started getting a much bigger audience. And they said, hey, look, we don't need all this government intervention. We don't need to direct the economy. You just need to control the money supply properly, and the economy will take care of itself without any government direction at all. Oh, and of course, we've got to cut taxes and cut regulation, too. This, of course, was supply-side economics, and it started to get more of a hearing in the late 1970s. And then, of course, Ronald Reagan won the election in 1980, and he was a supply-sider, and he put their principles into practice. So that was one thing that happened. Those traumas of the 70s opened the door to a new kind of economics. Another thing that happened, I would argue, it changed who Americans were. You alluded to this at the top of the hour, how we became more of kind of like a lookout for number one people. And in the book, I draw a distinction between these two great economic traumas of the 20th century, the Depression of the 1930s, and the great inflation and associated traumas of the 1970s. The Depression created a certain degree of solidarity among the populace, and the great inflation made people more likely to look out for themselves. These were two very seminal events, the former one paving the way for a more kind of communitarian politics, and the latter paving the way for a more individualistic politics.
Is it fair to say supply-side economics also worked until it didn't?
Well, okay, there's another big these economic questions. They're such big debates. I mean, I don't think so. No, it's worked great for the 1% or the 2%. It's worked well for the 10 or 12 or 15%. But, you know, you look around this country and you see these crises and you see these small towns and rural communities where there's no opportunity and where so many people are on drugs or selling drugs, and you know, these places are just falling behind so badly. I mean, this is, Chris, the central economic fact of our times. The divide between cities and small towns and rural areas. Cities are pretty vibrant economically. Of course, all cities have their pockets of dysfunction. But mostly cities are quite vibrant and thriving. But you go outside of cities, and except for, you know, university towns, which incidentally are doing fine because they get a nice infusion of federal money for a lot of things that are going on in those towns. But you go to smaller towns and rural areas, and there's just not a lot of opportunity. So, no, I don't think supply side has produced a general prosperity the way Keynesianism did in its best days. And indeed, this is what we're debating today. When Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says 60 or 70%, she didn't use the word Keynesianism, but that's what she's talking about. And we're at a point now where we're debating, for the first to me, quite overdue, for the first time in many years, does supply-side economics deliver for the general population?
Before we get to solutions, there's one other thing I want to talk about, and that is, to shorthand for our listeners, you are not a Newt Gingrich fan, but you do admit here that he is probably the most influential Republican of his lifetime.
He changed politics in very dramatic ways. There's no question about it. I have a couple of quotes from him in the book that I think are very telling quotes. He came into Congress in the late 1970s, and incidentally, when he was elected to the Georgia House delegation, I think he was the only Republican, or maybe there were two, out of, at that time, 10 or 11. So it was still a Dixiecrat, Democrat, solid South state, Georgia, as late as 1978. And he came in and, you know, I think your listeners generally know that he was more of a flamethrower, very harsh rhetoric sometimes. And he said, speaking in a not so veiled way of the then Republican leader, a man named Bob Michael of Illinois, who was conservative, but he was a compromiser. He played poker with the Democrats. He went golfing with them. He cajoled them into voting for certain things, and he compromised with them across the aisle. Excuse me. And Gingrich, the quote in the book is something like, "We don't need any more of these timid leaders who don't know how to fight." I mean, it's a more incendiary quote than that. I'm forgetting it right now, but it's a tough quote. And then the other quote, and this is quite a contrast to the World War II generation I spoke of earlier. Gingrich was asked by a journalist in the mid-90s why he hadn't fought in Vietnam, because he didn't. He got some kind of deferment. And he said, you know, given the things I believe, I probably should have gone, but there were bigger battles to be fought in Congress. I think that's very telling.
You know that the Democratic Party is made up of a kind of coalition of different kinds of interest groups, whereas the Republican Party looks largely like a unified movement. What are the Republicans unified around?
The Republicans are unified mostly around big, abstract philosophical principles. You know, less government, strong defense, lower taxes. And there's a lot of political science research on this, I cite the research in the book. There are surveys after surveys after surveys with rank-and-file Democrats and rank-and-file Republicans, and they show that rank-and-file Republicans are more likely to believe in these broad philosophical principles, whereas Democrats, they have their beliefs, of course, their philosophical beliefs, but they also tend to talk more about specific things. You know, like, let's do something about climate change. Let's protect the environment. Let's raise wages. Let's protect Social Security. Specific policy things rather than broad abstract principles. It has to do with the fact that, you know, the Republican Party, let's remember this. the Republican Party has been taken over by the conservative movement. So it's basically a movement party now. 30 or 40 years ago, there were moderate Republicans plus the movement conservatives. But now the moderate Republicans are basically gone. And it's all movement conservatives of one stripe or another. Some are more to the right than the others. But it's a movement party. And the Democrats aren't really that. You know, maybe they'll become that in 8 years. I don't know. There are signs that they're sort of starting to look like that a little bit on the left, but they're not anywhere near as far along that road as the Republicans are.
Why is there such a disincentive today for politicians to either compromise or even to take moderate positions, whether from the left or from the right?
Well, because we talked a little bit ago about these groups that are monitoring their votes. And if they cast a suspicious vote, they're going to have trouble. It invites trouble to compromise. That's the problem in Congress today. Again, I would say that this is especially true on the Republican side, although some Democrats are starting to talk this way, too. I'll tell this story through an anecdote that involves Barney Frank, the Massachusetts congressman. When he was retiring from Congress, he did an interview. And the person was asking him all these kinds of questions, why they don't compromise and cooperate. And he says to the interviewer, he says, yeah, you know, my constituents ask me this all the time. And I say to them, how much compromising with Michelle Bachmann would you want me to do? And his constituents then say to him, you mean like they're all like Michelle Bachmann? She was much in the news at the time. It was like 4 or 5 years ago. And he said, no, they're not all like Michelle Bachmann. Half of them are like Michelle Bachmann. And the other half are afraid of getting a primary challenge from someone like Michelle Bachmann. And I have, you know, backed that up with reporting that I've done separately. There are groups on the conservative side that, you know, if you're a Republican member of Congress, and this is while there's a Democratic president, you know, it's not so operative while there's a Republican president, but while Obama was president, and if you voted for a judge, or if you voted for an Obama budget, or if you voted for, you know, some other major Obama initiative, there were people in the district who want to run against you, and they could be financed by these groups like the Club for Growth, which have a lot of money to throw at these primaries. So if you're that kind of member of Congress, you don't fear a general election in the slightest. There's no chance, the way these districts are cut these days, that you're going to lose to a Democrat. There is a chance you're going to lose to another Republican who is to your right. And that's what they're worried about. So the incentive structure says, don't cast the vote. Why cast the vote? All it's going to do is invite trouble. I'm going to get attacked. Somebody else is going to raise $300,000 off of it, and so on and so on and so on. Now, there's talk on the Democratic side of primarying some of these more moderate Democrats. There's this Democrat outside of Chicago, Dan Lipinski. He's one of the last remaining pro-life Democrats, anti-abortion rights. And there's talk among Democrats of trying to run primaries against him and a handful of other people. So the same dynamic might be coming into play on the Democratic side. But there's no, as of yet, there's no machinery on the Democratic side to make that happen the way there is on the Republican side.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. You remind us that we've had the same number of congressional seats, House seats, since 1910, even though the population of the country has more than tripled. What are the consequences of that?
Well, that we have a government that is more remote from the people. So this goes back to the French philosopher Montesquieu, who said, you know, he's one of the great theorists of democratic republican form of governments. And he said that, you know, they have to be small to work, and they have to be small in scale. And he would undoubtedly think the United States is way too big and a disaster. But he also said representatives need to be close to their people. And all of our founders read him and other philosophers who said similar things. And at the Constitutional Convention in 1787, they set the size of a congressional district at 30,000. And they said, this is where, of course, our census comes from every 10 years. They said, we'll have a census every 10 years. And as the population grows, we'll somewhat expand the size of these districts. And we'll grow the House of Representatives along with the growth in population. And that happened until 1910. And then, obviously, the population kept growing, but they stopped adding representatives. So we had 435 representatives when there were 90 million people in this country, and when a congressman represented about 260 or 70,000 people. And today, we still have 435 when we have 320 million people, and a member of Congress represents about 730 or 40 or 50,000 people. Now, I talk about this in the last chapter, and I think that expanding the size of the House of Representatives modestly is a good idea, but I think it needs to be done in conjunction with some other changes that might help produce more moderate members. Because if we're just going to expand it and have more intense partisans on both ends, that does no good. But if we can expand it in a way that might produce more moderate members. And the main idea for this is having at-large districts or multi-member districts that aren't as aggressively gerrymandered. Then I think it would be worth doing.
My guest is Daily Beast columnist and New York Times contributing opinion writer Michael Tomasky. We're talking about his book, If We Can Keep It, How the Republic Collapsed and How It Might Be Saved. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. We have phone lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send us email to think@kera.org, or you can find us on Twitter at @KERAThink. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with contributing New York Times opinion writer and Daily Beast columnist Michael Tomasky, whose new book is called If We Can Keep It, How the Republic Collapsed and How It Might Be Saved. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Okay, Michael, how would you divide up at-large districts and single-member districts, reminding people that, of course, now our congressional representatives all come from single-member districts?
Yeah. And incidentally, single-member districts are a whole other issue that we may not have time to get into. But for people who buy the book, read chapter one. It's a fascinating, weird, disturbing history. You know, I'm not an expert on this, but I would divide it something like this. I mean, I would not do away with single-member districts. I think, you know, we've had them for so long, for 240 years. You can't just ditch something that you've had for 240 years. But I think in the larger states, and there is one proposal in Congress along these lines by a Democratic congressman from Virginia. I think in the larger states, you can create regions and elect a certain number of representatives from those regions so that about half of the state's congressional delegation is elected on that regional basis. So in the state where you're sitting, Texas, I mean, I don't know, you'd have, it's an awful big state. I guess you'd have maybe four or five regions that have roughly equal population and that are not aggressively gerrymandered themselves. And from these regions, you know, from the rural ones, you'd elect more Republicans, of course, and from the urban ones, you'd elect more Democrats. But it just wouldn't be as bad, I don't think, and other experts who've looked at this don't think it wouldn't be as bad as aggressively gerrymandered single member districts. You'd get some people who would have to appeal to a broader electorate. I also think, and this is, again, is not just me, but experts in the field of electoral reform think it, that you could combine this with what they call ranked choice voting, in which people rank all of the people running from first to last as their preferential choice. What would this do? Well, it would do a lot of things, but I mean, one thing that it might do is cut back a little bit on negative campaigning. Because if I'm running against you and two other people, I want to be, and if you are people's first choice, I want to be their second choice. So I don't want to act like a big jerk while I'm campaigning. You know, I want them to kind of like me. like me well enough to rank me second.
So there are a lot of folks sitting in Congress today who have been there for years or decades and are comfortably ensconced in what you call aggressively gerrymandered districts. How do you convince this constituency of people who are now lawmakers to change the very circumstances that put them where they are?
Well, it's actually happening in some states. I mean, the it in this case is that we have independent redistricting commissions rather than the district lines being redrawn by state legislatures. A few states were doing it before 2018. A number of states passed independent commissions in 2018. I can't remember the exact number, but 6 or 7 or 8, and they passed them by comfortable margins. And these weren't just dark blue states. You know, this wasn't Vermont. These were purple states, and they passed by comfortable margins. So there's clearly some bipartisan support for this idea of independent commissions. Now, you know, they're not going to solve every problem in the world, but they will probably draw fairer districts than state legislatures would. Whether they can survive the Supreme Court is another question. But if we can move in the direction of these commissions, that'll help things.
We have an email here from Lauren in Dallas who wants to know, when did politicians start worrying only if they'll get reelected and not about what is best for this country?
Well, you know, I guess I just wouldn't put it quite that way. I mean, politicians have always been worried about getting reelected. You know, I mean, John Adams was just intensely worried about getting reelected, and he failed at it. And in one of the craziest elections in our history, the presidential election of 1800, there was no time when, again, to go back to something I was saying a little while ago, there was no time when they were better people or had better principles.
Mm-hmm.
Or loftier, you know, ways of looking at the job of politics. There were, however, times when the social forces beckoned them more toward compromise and less toward division. Okay? So that's really the way I would say to this emailer. That's the way you need to think of it. It's not that they're worse people today. It's that they are impacted by a bunch of forces that press them toward non-compromise. And so we need to think about ways to press them toward compromise. It's harder to think of. I have some thoughts in the last chapter of the book, but, you know, this is not going to be solved fast. But the problem is not that they were better people at a certain point in history. They weren't.
All right, let's go to the phones now. We have Andrew calling from Arlington. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Chris. Thank you very much. I had a question for the visitor on the subject of political divisiveness in Congress, as well as how to make Congress compromise. And I wondered if there ever has been a time, or why not, do the lawmakers try to tie in ideological divisive positions together? Like, if the Republicans want a wall, why not try to tie it together in an overall immigration bill where, yes, they get a wall, but we also get a streamlined application process and greater legal status quotas and more asylum seekers to be able to come through. So, yes, both sides win, but both sides also give up on something they don't want. Or why not tie something like gun legislation to an overall crime bill or even to another ideological divisive point? And I just wanted to know your opinions on that.
Thanks for calling.
Well, that's a good question. I think there are efforts along those lines, you know, not with respect to the wall specifically, although, you know, there was a lot of border security money in the 2005 bill that President Bush wanted, and then to the 2013 bill that Obama wanted and that the Senate did indeed pass on a bipartisan basis. You can go back and read about that bill. It passed, I think, in June of 2013, and it had 68 votes in the Senate, and 14 of those were Republican. For this day and age, that's a very bipartisan bill. And it was a good compromise bill. No wall, but fencing and border security and all that stuff, and a path to citizenship. But that got killed basically by right-wing talk radio. On the subject of guns, a bill very much as the caller describes passed in 1994. That was the Clinton era crime bill. Now, what happened in the, it passed in the early fall of 1994, not long before those 94 elections. And what happened then is that the NRA put millions of dollars into defeating about 20 or 25 people who voted for it because it had a gun control element to it, the assault weapons ban. And those people lost. So everybody else took away the lesson. Well, I'm not going to do that, you know, because they're going to come after me next time. So I'm not going to cast that vote. So, you know, that compromise was attempted and indeed became law in 1994. But you know, the NRA made it such that there was not going to be that kind of compromise again. And now, of course, that crime bill is heavily attacked on the left as well for locking up, millions of young, mostly African-American men.
One suggestion you make here would take place far outside of Washington, or mostly. You say we should consider restructuring college undergraduate programs. What would you change?
Here's the broad category here. So I spent some time arguing in this last chapter that we can't expect the politicians to lead us out of this gulch because that's just not what they do. You know, they're in a system where they keep getting reelected individually. The incumbent reelection rates are 97-98%. So they're not going to just wake up one day and say, gee, let's change this system where I have a job for life. You know, they're not going to do it. So we need to change things besides politics. We need to change ourselves a little bit because we changed too. As I said, half an hour ago, we changed in the 70s and 80s. We're real strangers to each other now. So I started thinking about ideas that could maybe do something about that. Social changes, I guess, more than capital P political changes. And this is one thing that I came up with. Okay, so, back after World War II, when the world was shrinking and the United Nations came into existence and, all that sort of thing, we set up these big foreign student exchange programs, these cultural exchange programs, so people from the rest of the world could learn more about America and we could learn more about the rest of the world. Millions and millions of kids went on these Fulbright scholarships and so on. Well, I say in this book, we're like that here within the United States today. You know, kids from Massachusetts, a city in Massachusetts, have no conception of what life is like in Mississippi, or kids from, Kansas don't have any conception of what life's like in Seattle. So let's have, on a voluntary basis, you can't make people do this, but let's see if state universities, public schools, can set up some kind of exchange program where people can go do a year somewhere else. At least, you know, they'll get to see what life is like and what kind of values people have in this other part of the country. And at least they won't be complete strangers to each other. Maybe after 15 or 20 years of this and a few million kids doing it, it might make some difference. Some of those kids might end up in Congress. Who knows?
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. What evidence do you see that far right-leaning or left-leaning political leaders might actually prefer to take more moderate positions if it wasn't untenable for their ability to stay in office?
I know that they'd rather be doing their jobs, most of them. I know this just from reporting and people I talk to on the Hill. I know, for example, and this comes mostly from Democrats who tell me this, but they have told me that Republicans come up to them on an issue like climate change and say privately, look, I know, you know, this is a thing, and I should probably vote for this, but I just can't. I'm going to be crucified. I'm going to be crucified if I vote for this. So, like, that's the problem, you know? And I'm sure it happens in the other direction, too. But I do know that many of them would like to compromise more. They're just, they don't, they can't, they feel they can't. They don't have the courage to stand up to powerful groups that have a lot of money that might be able to defeat them in the next election.
Do you think there's more pressure among Republicans than among Democrats in 2019?
Yes, in general terms, there is, in ways that I've described. Like, you know, there's this, the Club for Growth is an organization that will fund Republican primaries. And there are a couple of other organizations like that. And there's no real analog to those groups on the Democratic side. At the same time, I would say that, you know, with a Republican president, there's less pressure on the Republican side. You know, I mean, when Obama was president, excuse me, if you were a Republican and cast something that could be interpreted as a pro-Obama vote, look out. Now, that exists on the Democratic side now, too. And so you see that, you know, no Democrats voted for the big tax bill, at least none in the Senate. I don't know if there were one or two in the House, but if there were, it was a very negligible number.
Do you see an appetite among sort of regular people, regular Americans who are not planning to run for office, to get involved and work on making some of these changes or calling for some of these changes? A lot of us are used to sort of patting ourselves on the back for just showing up on Election Day.
Yeah. Well, we're seeing certainly a lot more activism. I wouldn't say that it's dedicated to the reduction of polarization. It's probably dedicated to the increase in polarization to the extent that it's dedicated to beating the other side. But, mm-hmm. I mean, that's what we saw on the liberal Democratic side with groups like Indivisible that formed thousands of chapters across the country. And Indivisible, these chapters obviously had a huge, huge effect on turnout in the 2018 elections. So, you know, where are we headed? You know, we're in the short term, we're headed toward more division and I think a very, very rancorous 2020 presidential campaign.
Michael Tomasky's new book is If We Can Keep It, How the Republic Collapsed and How It Might Be Saved. Michael, really interesting conversation. Thanks for making time for us this hour.
I really appreciate you having me. Thanks.
You can follow us on Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. You can use your favorite podcast app to become a regular subscriber to the free Think podcast. And you can find out what we have planned for upcoming shows at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.